Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 201 on how to run real estate Facebook ads with Chad Keller. If you are into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers, invite them on the show, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars or more in the business of real estate. Our guest today is Chad Keller. Chad is a real estate investor, a Facebook and marketing funnel expert, and the co-founder of Motivated Leads, a digital marketing agency that helps real estate investors expand their portfolios quickly by generating quality, motivated seller leads. The big idea here is advertising directly to sellers for off-market deals. It is one of the most reliable methods for building a real estate agent or a real estate investing business. Chad and I discuss how to run Facebook and Google ads for motivated sellers. We also dive deep into his own experience as a real estate investor with his method on choosing very specific houses in very specific neighborhoods for very specific reasons to maximize returns. Shall we begin?
All right, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. Chad, how are you doing today?
Good, Dan. Good. How about yourself?
I'm also doing well. Yeah. So let's get started with a little bit of a location stamp. I'm recording from Chicago. What market are you living, focused in? And before we dive into the rest of it, we'll probably start with real estate stuff. So market, location.
We're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We work with investors throughout the nation, but our market specifically is Pittsburgh.
Okay, cool. Before we get into the real estate topic, I was doing some research on LinkedIn. I think I saw that you had built and sold three e-commerce brands. Would you mind just touching on that, going a little bit of a dive on that before we get started?
Yeah, that's pretty much actually how I got into marketing. It was about 8 years ago. I was selling products on Amazon. Facebook was kind of in its heyday, where you could really put up anything and have a good product that differentiated itself a little bit. And that's when ads were so new, ad space was very cheap. You could get like 10 to 15 ROAS, which is return on your spend, on those channels, on Facebook specifically. So I was able to grow e-commerce brand pretty large in about 18 months. Off of that one brand, it was actually a brand that we put wood veneer that you put on like kitchen cabinets. We put it on like phone cases, bottle openers, did a lot of wholesale and everything. But also then created other brands that would sell those products without the veneer on them. So it was like three brands encompassed within one product. Was able to get that acquired. And then that kind of just, we were making so much money, having videos go viral, we were reinvesting that money into Facebook. So kind of self-taught myself Facebook from that, and then started consulting for startups and then get more into marketing and started a marketing agency.
Nice. Was the choice or the decision to sell the company driven on a ridiculous valuation and a price that you couldn't walk away from? Or was it more of wanting to just sheerly do something else in a new challenge? Or was it, you know, driven by maybe the ROAS, the return on ad spend, starting to shrink? Like, what led to actually deciding to sell the asset?
I wish it was the valuation, but it was not.
Okay.
When you get into like manufacturing, especially shipping from China and everything into manufacturing, we were literally making laser cutting, doing all this work and doing the marketing on top of it. Got an offer that was fairly decent. And we were like, you know what, let's take it. Really enjoy doing the marketing side of things a lot more than being hands-on with shipping and the labor and everything, building the brand aspect of things. So it really just gave me the opportunity and freedom to focus more on what I found that I love to do. And that's really the true reason why it was sold.
Nice. Yeah. So, I mean, I hear you talk about the manufacturing component and I relate it to real estate in a sense that, I mean, they're phone cases, right? So what were we talking, like a $20, $30 average sale, cost per sale, something like that?
So our biggest product was a battery charging phone case for iPhones. So that was actually like a $100 sale, but we had them that all the way down to $20. So yeah.
So it scares the crap out of me when I think of having to make a Facebook ad profitable or any kind of ad, right? I don't care if it's direct mail, I'm putting ads in a newspaper, I'm running TV spots, I'm doing Google, I'm doing, you know, you name it, right? To get marketing to work on a $100 product requires a huge amount of volume. And then we bring in the risk of like overseas manufacturers and having to handle that. So I can like totally understand wanting to kind of free up from that. And I think like most people listening to the show right now, when we take real estate, even if it's a wholesale deal in the low end, Chad, I mean, I remember doing wholesale deals for like $2,500, you know, and that was life-changing money for me. And of course, we've made more money on deals since then and continue to do like an average size of deal, let's say $10,000, $15,000 or more, you know, especially when we flip a house. We have a very large sale. So it feels like I don't have to be quite as efficient with the way that I put together the ads, or I can make a lot more mistakes because I can kind of get lucky on one of these deals and make 18 grand and cover like a $5,000 mistake versus the smaller price per product. So I think real estate is attractive because of that high dollar per sale, and you don't need that huge amount of volume. Of course, we have risks of labor and material costs going up with inflation and things of that nature, break in. So there's other risks that we're certainly putting ourselves out to encounter as real estate investors. But on the flip side, when we're talking marketing and sales businesses, like we're going to be describing getting into here today, Chad, I mean, you know, the high dollar product really allows for a lot of mistakes, learning moments. Optimization can really turn into like a snowball effect on the other side. I mean, would you kind of touch on that as you explored getting into real estate and how you discovered, you know, this from the e-commerce business?
Yeah, definitely. I started doing a lot of lead gen for even like Fortune 500 companies, performance lead gen, where I was gambling my own ad spend and be paid back. They would basically pay me per lead. So if I got a lead for $20, they'd pay me $25, so on. That's what really opened my eyes to lead generation. But you're always operating on like margins of like $5 to $10 within that. But real estate, like if we get a property for anywhere in the specific areas that we buy and hold in, if we get a property for anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000, we're super happy. Like sometimes we'll even push it to 10. I'll pay 10 to get a property that's 70% ARV all day. So gives you a lot of wiggle room. As you said, it does give you a lot of room. I mean, still you're trying to keep it as cheap as possible. But it is a lot more freedom when you're doing real estate versus e-com products.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like lottery tickets sometimes, especially in the beginning. It's like I'm running some ads, nothing's working, and like, boom, one of them hits, and it just kind of like fixes everything instantly in real estate. And I think that's a double-edged sword because someone can stay buckled down and figure out the systems and optimize and really pay attention and focus on their business when that occurs, or someone can have the lottery hitting mentality and like go take a vacation and think like, wow, I'm just like the most magical person in the world. We just, you know, did this deal. We flipped it, whatever. We made $60,000 flipping this house. Like it can be very easy for someone to like mentally check out. So it's a gift and a curse in the same time, you know, to have that big dollar sale, if you will, that's involved in real estate. And things can go dramatically wrong the other way. We're in a period of time here, certainly in the last 24 months, you know, even more so in the last 10 to 12 years, where we haven't seen markets cool off. I mean, I've seen micro markets cool off, and we've lost six figures plus on a couple of the deals we were flipping. But overall, it's been a really good run for real estate, and I don't really see the demand kind of cutting off anytime soon here, truthfully. Would you mind touching on your real estate experience, how you got into that from the e-commerce and what your real estate component of the business currently is, Chad?
Yeah, definitely. So the market here is pretty hot as well, but it was about, I want to say 4 or 5 years ago, my partner now in Motivated Leads, Brian, he always did SEO, and I was always on the paid ad spend growth side of businesses, like just helping with overall growth, sales funnels, all of that. And I saw what he was doing with the profits from his agency. He was just investing in real estate, where I was just like holding cash and playing around the stock market here and there, did some crypto. And, but I saw like how he was doing the burn method within real estate, and I begged him to get into it. I was just like, man, I want to get some houses. I want to get some. So he finally let me in on it. We started buying houses in there's two neighborhoods here in Pittsburgh that had a really good school district, three bedroom, two bathroom homes, single family homes. So you get really good renters. And you can get the properties if you run ads anywhere before they hit the market, anywhere from like 90,000 to 110,000. You put about 20, 30 into them and they all assess over 200. Sometimes they even assess over 220. So that return is unreal. And he taught me a lot about it where we don't over leverage ourselves. So if we can go, if that property assesses at 220, 230, we still only pull out that original 100 that we put in. We don't pull out our repair costs. So if a recession or something does hit, we're not too impacted here in Pittsburgh. You're not going to have a drastic recession happen or property values going to drop by 50% or anything like that. So yeah, we've been doing that for about, I would say 4 or 5 years now. I've built a pretty good portfolio.
Nice. I like the 3-bed, 2-bath, right? So, and the school district selection. So I think my own asset selection, I mean, we flip a lot of houses. I think we've done 268 so far this year. And then, you know, we invest personally, the partners, in our own real estate portfolios. I'm a big fan of like, we can flip houses together and kind of have like this end date where this partnership may no longer work for the next one if we decide that it doesn't, it's not going to be a fit. Or it may work because we liked working together, but I don't like the idea of owning rental property long term. I'm very hesitant to invest in like syndication deals where I'm having to rely on some other operator for like a 5 or 7 or 10 year period. That's a long time. A lot of things can change. People may not even live that long, regardless of how old we are at the current time. Like nothing's guaranteed. So I'm always a fan of holding rental properties myself, and it probably holds me back from greater returns, maybe by not, you know, doing long-term partnerships with rentals, but it's more of a risk mitigation thing. It's me being conservative kind of in the same way. And where I'm going with that is my own asset selection process has become like, I want beds and baths the same way, like a 3-bed, 2-bath. There's probably a whole lot more 3-bed, 1-bath houses scattered around that same area. So if I have a tenant living in my 3-2, they probably have 1 or 2 kids, maybe even 3 kids in the school system. And it's going to be hard for them to find a replacement rental property with the 2 bathrooms, which is like mighty convenient. And, you know, you layer in the better school district as part of your selection strategy. Like, I like that. My own strategy is to kind of pick areas that are safe. It's not a strictly cash flow driven model. And then I'm trying to maximize it and have like, you know, 14%. 15% cap rate or something like that, where the cash flow is crazy. I'm happier buying something and keeping some cash in the deal, just like you, where I feel like I'm buying in the right spot. Maybe it's in advance of like neighborhoods that are starting to see new construction here in Chicago. I really love Bronzeville and some of those areas, but anywhere I could buy in advance of growth and people investing and get the higher number of bedrooms and bathrooms, like to me, that's really high quality assets, right? So do you usually get those? You said before they hit the market, they go for 90 to 110. Are these typically going to be properties that you've generated a lead that you paid for in order to get in the living room and negotiate that? Or do you have some other methods for obtaining your deals, Chad?
Yeah, primarily it's all driven through Facebook and Google. We do have some friends that are just realtors that will contact us with something that just got listed, and they'll be like, hey, if you make a fair offer on this, you can probably get it. It kind of fits within your portfolio. But most of them, yeah, I would say 90% of them are driven from Facebook and Google.
And do you actually like call the seller yourself, head on out, negotiate face to face? What does that look like?
Yeah. So what we do is we send everyone that clicks one of our Facebook ads, they come through a form. That form is 10 to 12 steps, asking them like why they want to sell, how quick do you want to sell, how much do you owe on the property, how long have you owned the property, make sure it's not listed, what's the ultimate goal with the property. So they're pretty well vetted. As soon as they come through, give them a call, try to set that appointment to go out and view the property. We go view the property. We just have the negotiations there, tell them what we'll offer. Some people take it on the spot. Some people just be like, hey, I'll let you know. So it's, very laid back about it, but, they're starting to know us a lot in the community just because we've been buying, and my partner lives in the community as well. So, they trust us a lot, which is nice to have versus like a wholesaler that's coming in just trying to push them to basically like grab the deal and get out of there. So it's a little different aspect that way, but we've had a lot of success.
Nice. So you talk about them being vetted. What type of close rate? Are you going on 10 appointments for every deal with this laid back strategy? Is it a 1 in 5, a 1 in 20? How many offers are made for each deal that you end up with under contract?
Usually out of say 8 leads. eight leads. That's not appointments going to see them. That's eight leads in the door. We'll usually get a deal from it. And out of those eight leads, we'll probably go see two or three properties. Two of the properties might want full price. And no matter what, when you talk to them on the phone, like, they'll tell you the condition of this. So to say, hey, I know what the market's like right now and I want that. So we'll push it to, we'll push it to a realtor and they'll list it and give us a little kickback. Some of the properties just doesn't make, they don't make sense for us from an investment standpoint. Maybe they need too much work or the clean out is just too heavy. Like, we want to sell a hoarder's house about, I want to say this was about 2 months ago. It was like the second floor bathroom bedroom was fell down into the dining room and it was just a mess and it was too much work for us. So we pushed to one of our wholesale buddies. He wanted to wholesale the property and just cut us a check on it. So yeah, about one in eight leads, if you vet them right, you're going to pay a lot per lead. Like in Pittsburgh, we're fortunate. We pay about $100 per lead. And we don't have management fees of an agency like a typical client would with us. But in Chicago, for instance, you're probably going to pay about $150 a lead. If you're in Salt Lake City, San Diego, you're paying like $300, $400 a lead. So it really depended upon your market, the cost of those leads as well.
Yeah, it's pretty solid. Eight leads, $800 to get a deal that you are willing to buy. That's pretty decent. Can you talk a little bit more about the lead quality? I mean, you kind of vetted them on the front end and there's like a certain philosophy around getting any leads, right? So I've paid for leads in the past and, you know, you like log in and you get the leads and probably everyone gets them who like joins the system. I'm not going to name on the air here. Versus, you know, this lead that is generated and it's exclusive to you, to the investor. I'm paying $100, $200, $300 for this lead. What is your philosophy around quality of leads and your process to get that to occur?
Yeah, we actually initially, we only started offering this to other investors about 2 years ago. But we set this up because we always ran agencies full time and investing was very passive to us. So we had to vet these leads very well. Because otherwise it was a waste of our time. So the process we use to set up, everything that we use is super direct, like the ads, everything. We always make every investor that comes to us, we make them their own brand if they don't have a brand. Like ours is 412 houses. 412 is our area code. Might have something like Chicago Cash Offer or I Buy Houses Chicago, Local Guy Buy Chicago, whatever you want to do. But we'll make the logo, the website, all the ad creatives, everything for the investor. And all the ads are really direct. There's a lot of people that will sign up or investors will sign up with, and these ads are just put out there for clickbait. Like our ads say, sell your house as is, get a fair cash offer. Are you in a situation you no longer want to be in with your house? Don't pay realtor fees, things like that. And the whole website is super direct as well. We never want to confuse the consumer and we want them to type in as much manual information as possible. We don't want automated forms on Facebook where they just click a button, it auto-populates their form and they hit submit. Now, those leads are just trash. So you want to bring them to a website, manually type in so they know what they're filling out. That way, they're actually going through a process that takes 10, 15 minutes for them to do. And they know what they're getting themselves into at that point. So you can get leads all day for $10, $20 on Facebook if you just automate it and get automated answers and everything. But it's not our process.
Yeah, I mean, there's like... certainly anyone who's designed their own website, like I have, there's like that push and pull of quality versus we want to capture all the information. You do research about like online and it's like, well, if you ask only for the email address, let's say you're signing up for a blog or some mailing list, you're getting such a significantly higher opt-in rate with just the email versus the email and the name. And an even lower opt-in rate if I add the email, the name, the last name, and then the cell phone number, right? And so there's like this balancing act, I feel like, from a marketer's perspective of finding the right amount of information versus the right amount of quality in the lead. And it sounds like you're leaning more on the side of, let me build in as much resistance as I possibly can, self-select out. We don't want to talk to you. We don't want to hear from you unless you're like the highly qualified lead. Does that sum up the mindset?
Correct. Yeah. We actually break it down to a two-step form. So on the front end, we optimize for both steps through the ads. But on the front end, we ask email, phone number, and address. We don't even ask name. That way, we have the information to contact them. We have the address to look at the house if we need to. And then we push them to step two to fill in all the other information. So about, you'll see about like 70% of people still fill in step two because they went through that first step, but still that 30% that fall off, you still grab that and have that information to contact them or throw them into a drip campaign, whether it's text or email, whatever it may be, to get back in front of them.
Did you do an A-B test with the name there and without the name on the first step of the form at some point to make that decision? Or was that like an intuition kind of a thing?
So actually, ever hear of Carrot?
Yep.
So Carrot, they did a lot of testing behind it. So we ran with it and they had it initially, like if you sign up for their site, like that's initially what they say to do because of the testing they did behind it. So we tried it that way, but we did try it on the front end at one point with the names because we had people that were complaining about the names not pulling into their CRM. So then the cards in the CRM just had no name associated with them. And you did see a lower conversion rate when that name was on there.
It wasn't about that.
It was like 2-3%. It wasn't anything crazy, but it still made an impact.
Yeah, because it's like of the 2%, that's 100 out of 100 leads. The question becomes, does the two leads who bailed, is one of them the lottery ticket deal that I kind of mentioned earlier? Like, is that the universe's deal where the person was like hesitating, they got the hoarder house, it's like really a great fit for a real estate investor to buy and flip that house, that's what's needed there. And because we were a little bit ambitious on the front end, they fell off early in the process and they're gone, you know?
Exactly. And then we drop them into like a drip sequence, which means like every day for like, sometimes they go up to 90 days, not every day, but every 48 hours or 3 days later, we'll send them an automatic text message that says, hey, you stopped by our site the other day. Were you still thinking about selling your house? Or we'd love to talk to you about selling your house. That way we're always pinging them and they'll match. We had a big, like one of our biggest wholesale deals that we passed to a partner actually came 4 months later from one of our drips. And in Pittsburgh, like a $40,000 wholesale deal is like very unheard of. But typically like average, like anywhere, like you were saying earlier, like 2,500 to like 15,000, like they're within there. And he grabbed it and we're like, man, where'd you get that? He was like, it was one of your leads. Like it came back. It was literally from like September. We're like, wow. Like it's crazy how like a drip, like you never even think about the drip. It's just there set up, but brought us 40,000, like brought out, well, we take half of that, brought us $20,000 out of nowhere.
So is that like they filled out form one and not form two and the auto drip is happening, or you auto dripping form one, form two, doesn't matter. We got a cell phone number there. They're getting auto dripped the text message.
Yeah. If we don't get a hold of them and they fill out a step two and we don't get a hold of them after like two calls, we'll still put them in the drip.
Okay. So it's like a physical decision to put them into the drip.
Unless they don't fill out a step two. If they don't fill out a step two, they automatically go into the drip.
Gotcha. It's funny how endless it can be, right? There's drip cycle for the email, drip cycle for the text now. And it's like the such a variety of ways to approach it and skin the cat. Like, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, no, that's like the world I come from, and all that. It's crazy what people do. Like even like voicemail drops that you can do where like the phone doesn't even ring and just leaves them a voicemail. That's the new thing that everyone's doing. But we don't like to get too spammy with it.
Yeah.
Brand name there. But yeah, it's not what people do nowadays.
And I guess it's like an opt-out kind of a sequence, right? Like it probably says there's marketing, you're putting in a number, there's permission type of thing, and then they can click stop to get out of it, something like that.
Yeah. And then one of our biggest flippers and wholesalers that we deal with, they fill out a step one on his site. He will actually, if he can't get a hold of them, he'll go to their house and knock.
Nice. Like, and just knock on the door.
It's that intense. Like he'll go there and just knock on the door. Like that's not our style, but like that just shows you like how, like just getting that initial information, he's literally doing like 20, 30 deals a month.
Nice.
And, like, you see his hustle. Like, we asked him how many, the most he ever called somebody, and like 300 times in a week.
300?
Yeah. We were like, that's not even real. And he's like, no, he's like literally like just had my assistant call, dialing nonstop because I wanted the property.
Huh.
And I was like, oh.
And he got the deal, I guess.
Yeah, he got the deal. So he just nonstop, and he's just like, he's high energy. It's a different level.
But what market is that?
He's in Kentucky.
Okay, so it's not even like a Los Angeles or Salt Lake City kind of
crazy market. So like, I think he branched out into like, I don't know what state it is. That's like 100 people on the branch there.
St. Louis or one of them over there, maybe.
Whatever's there. But he started in Kentucky, and now he's doing multiple states.
How about that? So what, I mean, we mentioned a couple mistakes. What would be a few common mistakes other people have done, or on the opposite end, like a few other strong strategies for setting up and optimizing a marketing funnel? I mean, we kind of touched on a few. Are there any that we missed here, mistakes or strengths?
The biggest mistake that you see people make when they're first getting into digital is they don't give it enough time. And that's where it just comes down to like acquisition costs and everything. This is an upfront investment. Granted, you got to pay about $1,500 to $3,000 a month all in, depending on the service you want to do. But the more data you pay for and the more clicks, the more reach that you get for your ads, the more data you get back. And that means the more optimization that you can make. So as you keep going, it all gets better. Granted, there's a point where it sits and this is your lead cost because this is your market. But a lot of people will give it like, we pre-vet people and we tell them when they come on, like, hey, this is, we ask you to give it 3 months. Because by then you should have a contract or two across the table. You should be able to measure your acquisition costs, your ROI, everything on this campaign. You need to give it that time. Some people get nervous coming in and they're spending $1,500 a month on ads and they've never done that before. They're just like, oh, we're burning money. I only got a couple of Bs and they didn't answer. But literally one lead two could be
a lottery ticket.
Yeah, exactly. So you just got to give it that time. And that's the biggest mistake that you'll see people make.
Yeah, I cringe. I guess it was like 2011. And I remember somebody had like a pay-per-click kind of agency. And I used to set all my own pay-per-click ads up myself at the time. I mean, I remember I got on Google, it was like 2006, 2007. And it was like $1.50 a click. Like if I go all the way back in my account, like, wow, these things are like a dollar a click. They're like $25, $35, $40 now. They figured it out. Then Facebook was the same way when you were talking about it like 8-9 years ago. It was kind of the Wild West before they, I don't know, reach critical mass and get to optimize things from their end as opposed to, luring us advertisers into the business. But anyway, I remember this agency had this thing where you would go in and rank the lead. You were supposed to like log in, rank the lead. It was $1,500, $2,000 a month. That was like $1 million to me at the time. Like, you know, I was driving like a 15-year-old pickup truck. I was like barely keeping the rent paid at the time. And I never logged into it. And I look back and I was like that client that probably should have been vetted. Like it was just so overwhelming to me, not only to spend the money, but like I missed all the nuance and the detail of having to go in, log in, rank the leads. He's like, did you rank the leads? What the hell are you talking about? Like, totally missed the ball on it. That long-term mindset and the ability to kind of keep putting money in when it doesn't feel like you're getting money out is real key. So for $1,500, $3,000 a month, Chad, is that a Facebook only strategy or is that also a pay-per-click strategy? What is that comprised of for an investor to kind of pull the trigger?
So we really let investors, if they're doing Facebook or Google ads, paid ads, we really let them like pick their price. Like you can be $1,500 all in where it's a $750 charge to us and $750 in ads. Just understand if you're starting that low, it's going to take like 2 months to get data back or sometimes even more if you're in a competitive market. We recommend that you start at $1,500 in ad spend and then our management fee is $1,500. That way you're getting data back quicker and seeing the true ROI of the program quicker. So you can start at $1,500 on the low end, dabble with it, get a few leads in the door. Cause we had a lot of people that never did digital before. So when a lead comes in, you gotta figure out your system and your cadence to call them, how you're gonna handle that and all that. So newer investors to digital that come to us, we ask them like, hey, just start slower. Start even like $1,000 management, $1,000 ad spend. Get a feel for the leads. Once you're comfortable, you can scale it up. So it's really dependent upon what you're comfortable with because we never want an investor coming to us and they're like, oh, this is a lot, like a ton of money that I'm spending a month. And like, I got enough for 3 months and I hope I make it. It's like, okay, well, let's just start slower. Let's make sure you get your pitch down and everything that, cause it's just newer calling these leads when they come in and everything, go to see the properties. You just learn as you go. So it's just really dependent upon the investor's budget and everything. We have guys that come in spending $20,000-$50,000 a month on ads cause they've been doing it and they have the team to back it up and they know what it can do cause their friends doing it, whatever it is. So it's just really dependent upon the investor.
Is it 50K ad spend also coupled with the 25K management?
No. So we actually max our management per platform at 1500.
Okay. So it's 1500. Got it. So that allows you to kind of scale up that way.
Yeah. So it's locked in. The most we'll charge is 1500. It's pretty much equal management to equal ad spend below 1500. But at 1500, our management fee is capped you can spend whatever you want to spend.
How much better does it get for that investor? I mean, if someone's coming and pulling the trigger on, you know, hey, I got 20 grand, Chad, am I best to do that in, you know, 5K a month so that I'm running $3,500 a month in ads for the 1500? What does that look like?
It's all dependent upon your market, to be honest. Like here in Pittsburgh, if we spend over about $3,000 a month on ads, we have diminishing returns where our lead cost is going up and we're not getting any more leads. But if you're in a market like LA or San Diego, Salt Lake City, in Phoenix, and you want to compete and you're willing to pay 10 to 15 grand to grab a deal because out there your splits are so big, then there you can just come and push down as hard as you want from month one. So it's so dependent upon your market and how much you want to take over the market that that your ad spend dictates that. So if you come to us with 20 grand per se, usually in the first month, we'll only say like, hey, max we'll spend is 5 grand. Just because we need to get data back and make some adjustments before we push down really hard. So after that, we'll scale up accordingly. You can only scale about 20% every 48 to 72 hours. I want to be smart about it. Don't want to just go waste your money. So it takes time to get to true scale, but every market has a capacity that you can push to unless you're doing like full states or multiple cities or multiple states, then you have like unlimited scale at that point. Where if you're doing the whole nation, you could literally spend $15,000 a day.
So what happens when you do go to like the whole nation versus certain markets, right? There's got to be some limit. Like you're saying 3 grand a month in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is what, 1.5 million people in the metro?
Yeah.
So at 1.5 million, you're hitting, you're kind of scaled out at 3 grand a month. I mean, if you went to five, what do you get? Like incrementally, how much higher?
Your higher lead costs, you just get higher lead costs.
Yeah. But you actually will get more leads that way?
You can get more leads, not guaranteed.
But yeah.
Usually what you do is you open up another channel. So like if you scale up Facebook to three grand a month, like I'm saying like total, like in Pittsburgh, even if we spend 1500 on Facebook, 1500 on Google, anything beyond that, we always paying a higher lead cost. And we don't need that many leads because we look for buy and hold every 45, 60 days. We're happy over here. But some guys, like they'll push one platform to the max and then add on Google and push that platform to the max. The more population that you have, the more data you have. So the cheaper your lead cost naturally is. So guys that do multiple states or a full state or multiple cities, they're going to have a much cheaper lead cost than somebody that just does one city or one county.
Do you have to have those cities be contiguous? Does it have to be, Grove City, Pittsburgh, out to somewhere in Ohio? Like, does it have to be in a circular geo where those cities are located? When you say multiple cities, or can it be like my example where it's Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Chicago?
So for our brand, it would only work in one city. Like we have 412 houses. We do national ad testing on a brand called USA Cash Offer. That pertains to the whole entire USA. We have family home buyers as well. That pertains to the whole USA. If you were able to do the whole state of Georgia, you make your brand something like Georgia Cash Offer, Georgia Community Home Buyer. If you're going to do multiple states, then you would make your brand something like Local Guy Buys Houses, where it's not specific to an area, but you can encompass all three of those states within one campaign. And that way you have a bigger data set to go after with those campaigns.
Gotcha.
So if you're going to do it, we always recommend putting them all together. And then Facebook will spend like, you might get to a point where it's like, hey, I'm getting too many leads in Atlanta and not enough in Chicago. We need to break it off. But if you do it all underneath one brand, you're going to have a cheaper lead cost doing it that way. So we position the brand based on the areas that you can target.
Nice. What are limits to scale? I mean, your guy at 40, 50 grand a month, is it like a population thing? Is there somewhere where there is some limit to the area that you get, a number of leads, something like that?
Yeah, it's limited to the area. So he's doing like LA, San Diego, like the kind of the hot areas in California, which is they're just naturally super competitive out there. So his lead costs are naturally $300 to $500 on Google. And he's willing to pay $10,000 to $15,000 to acquire a property. So it's really, if he's getting even two deals sometimes at a $50,000 ad spend, he's not upset. I mean, his splits are crazy. Yeah. So like, it's just another channel for him and he has the budget for it. So.
Yeah. I think one of my first podcast episodes ever were a guy that was doing LA County, I think. And he was saying that he did like $80,000 in mail to get like two deals, and each of the deals was probably $80,000 or $100,000 in spread. I'm like, man, that just feels like such a risky proposition. Like, what if the optimization of the funnel was such that the two people who fell off, like we used in our example earlier, was supposed to be allocated as one of those deals? Like, man, that's like a losing proposition. But I guess if you're there and you're doing it, it's a different story, right? Just playing at a bigger stakes table.
We have an investor in San Diego, and she flips, and her splits, like after she flips, are anywhere from $300,000 to $800,000 on her deals. And that just showed, like, that's what that market is out there. And she's like a designer too, so she makes these places all nice. So she has huge margins where she can spend as well.
Nice. So did I forget to ask anything about Facebook, Google, or any of the other ad strategies that you feel like we should share here on the air?
No, I mean, a lot of people ask like, hey, what's better, this one or that one? Facebook, you're going to get cheaper leads. You're going to get pretty much the same conversion rate on the leads. That's because like you're paying for impressions on Facebook. So you get more reach for your money no matter what. On Google, your conversion rate's pretty true to Facebook. Your acquisition cost is pretty true there as well. But you're going to pay a little bit more just overall. So it's a little bit scary for people to tap into Google. Because in the beginning stages, like where on Facebook, you might start off getting 5 or 10 leads in the first month in your market, where on Google, you might only get 2 or 3 leads. That's just because you're going up against like Zillow, iBuyers, all these big players where you haven't hit optimization yet. You got to give Google a little bit more time, but it'll catch up. So we always start people on Facebook too, just because you're paying more per click on Google, and you can retarget those people through Facebook. So if you have Facebook set up, then you can add on Google and retarget that way. So if you're debating like, hey, what one should I start with? I would always start with Facebook.
Gotcha. So speaking of Zillow, the iBuyers, the rest of them, maybe even the market as a whole, where do you think the real estate market is heading here in the next 2 or 3 years, Chad?
I think there's a point where it has to pull back a little bit and open up. I don't know when that is, but I can't see it continuing like this. I was reading an article the other day about how this this TikToker actually exposed it, where Zillow is like, they have this data and this AI tool that comes in and sees that, hey, there's 30 houses for sale in this market, and everyone's willing to pay $200,000 a house right now. We're going to come in and buy 25 of these houses at $200,000, but the last 5, we're going to buy at $250,000, and we're going to raise the value of these other 25 that we bought by buying those last 5 at $250,000. So like that's starting to be exposed, and a lot of people are starting to see that. And Zillow's starting to do more and more of that. So as that happens, I think that'll even bust. And they're doing a lot of that now, and they're controlling the markets in some areas, and especially smaller cities. I don't think that can continue.
Wow.
We'll see how that all plays out.
I feel like that's like a price fixing, anti-competitive, monopolistic charge heading down from Congress kind of thing. I mean, is there truth to that, or is that like this TikToker?
Yeah, it just went viral. It actually was like 2 weeks ago, went super viral. And now like everyone's looking into it because he was an agent himself in those areas and like an investor himself. And he was sick of it happening. And he noticed it when like there was literally like 20 houses in one market that like it was a slower market too, but they were all closed on within like a week to 2 weeks.
How about that?
How did 20 houses, and here they all went to the same buyer?
Zillow.
And it was them. Yeah. So they're like, okay. And they saw what they're doing. In some instances, they're even like taking like those 20, putting $5,000-$10,000 into them to like justify that extra $100,000 they're going to charge when they put them back on the market, because they got those other 5 at $250,000.
So. Yeah. I mean, I guess they got the 20 that were on the market though. They must've gotten them direct, right? Like the Zillow offers.
Yeah. Well, they're even buying them like off the market too, like on the market.
Oh,
buying them on the market. But you figure if you have 20 houses in a neighborhood and you buy them at 200, and then the last 5 that sell at 250, and the square foot is similar or smaller than those original 20, and they're just as nice, like you just put $50,000 on those first 20.
Yeah, that's That's interesting. In a sense, it's like what real estate developers have always done. Buy a 10-acre plot, subdivide, prepare to build 100 houses, build the first three, sell them for 200, build the next three, sell them for 210, 220, build the next three, sell them for 228. And so they're like constantly upping the ante for the rest of the houses, except Zillow does it in a more, you know, it's a market making method. It's mind blowing actually to hear it, if that's actually true.
Yeah. I mean, what can you do? Besides if the government steps in, I don't know. Because they're so big now, it's going to be hard to control.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily like it's a bad thing when we're outbid for the houses that we're going to get. I think it's a very bad thing for the consumer. And it feels like it's way in opposition to Rich Barton's operating principle, power to the people, which was what he initially had come up with, you know, when he put Expedia together. And then when he put Zillow together, he's wanting to give power to the people, give you the ability to book your own travel online. Here's the tools. Here's the information. Give the real estate community, here's the estimated values. Here's the, you know, potentially the for sale by owner platform. And now here's Zillow offers. And so it feels so contradictory to that if the company is actually doing a market making kind of a scenario. I mean, we had a perfect storm occur obviously with COVID, and a lot of people moved plans forward 5, 6, 8 years. I think people were faced with their own mortality and started to really cut the procrastination and start to make their moves. And I think there's people who are certainly like my age, 40, 41, and younger, the millennials, who are like in the first time home buyer year. And we're having this like, we're still on, like the wave is coming still of millennials. And we're probably like here on the wave, meaning like the peak of the number of millennials in home buying years, it still has yet to come. And it started later because the recession, the crash and all those things. And the 2008, 9 and 10 years were actually at the very trough of when first time home buyers, so the least number of demographics, like the age of people who are buying houses, the number of first time home buyers was at its lowest in society in 2008, 9 and 10, just after we vacuumed up all of the demand with, you know, the faulty underwriting and mortgages and things of that nature. So now we have the demand still coming. So it's like, the prices could hold until we're like on the back end of the wave, right? And then, you know, then the demand kind of falls, and maybe if the interest rates tick up. So it's anybody's guess as far as what's going to happen. I could see it continuing to hold and be stable. I could also see a large number of foreclosures cycling through here in the next year or two. And, you know, the inventory's ticking up, but it's not going to stop me from buying. I'm going to keep on kind of doing my thing, right?
Same here. We're talking about just like, how can we buy more recently? So,
yeah. And, you know, real estate's a function of the rents that are produced. Are the rents more now than they were in 2009 or 2005 in Pittsburgh?
Honestly, I don't know. Cause I'm 32.
Okay.
My partner, Brian, he's 41. So he more so went through that. So I fully don't know, but naturally, like in the hot areas here, even over the last 2 years, rents have gone up. Even just for us on like rentals in our place, like not much, I would say about 10%.
That's a lot. That's a huge.
I guess that's a lot in the last 2 years. But yeah. So I mean, you're just gonna see that with inflation and everything.
Yep. And that's kind of the thing. It's real estate's a function of the rent that's produced. That's a way that it derives its value. So if I take Philadelphia as an example, I mean, 2009 or 2010, a house was probably renting for $700. That same house in the same condition now is probably in that neighborhood where that is, where I'm thinking of, it's probably $1,100 a month, maybe $1,050. And if it were totally renovated, decked out, we would be talking like probably $1,400, $1,450. So the rents have doubled since 2009, or even back it up to 2006 when the market was kind of at its most hyped and hottest in Philadelphia. And so have the property values doubled. So if I kind of like use that as like a metric or a basis, how much rent does this property generate? I don't know that the values are all that far detached from reality, especially not to the level that they were in 2006. So I feel safe buying property, and I think I'll continue to do the same.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's the safest way right now, even to like go against inflation and everything. And I do crypto as well, but you have no clue what's going to happen there.
Yeah. So. I'm a little scared of the crypto thing.
So most secure, I would say, is real estate. So we'll continue to buy as well.
Nice. So any book recommendations you would make, Chad?
Well, book recommendations. A book that changed my life. I was at like a low point in my life, went like bankrupt before I started my e-commerce company, was How to Win Friends and Influence People. Completely changed my life. I gift that to a lot of people. It's a classic, but it's a great one.
Nice. So if we were to go for the crown jewel of wisdom, let's just say it was the moment right then when you read How to Win Friends and Influence People, right? You're coming back off of a challenging period of time, and you know what you know now, and you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom with yourself then. What would it be?
Putting yourself in uncomfortable situations and taking risks. I think that is the thing that has always put me far above some of my peers and everything, is that I'm always willing to take risks, and I always put myself in the most uncomfortable situations. That's how you grow.
Can you give me an example of one?
The most uncomfortable situation I've ever been in. I was actually like a millionaire before the age of 21 from some crazy stuff that I used to do. Lost everything. It's down to my last $40,000. Created a investment Shark Tank company here in Pittsburgh. Bought my way into a angel investment meeting to where it was like this big luncheon and everything. And I was just like, you know what? I'm going to buy this $1,000 ticket, even though like I shouldn't. And actually end up meeting the guy that I started the e-commerce company with.
How about that?
Oh, yeah. So I did not belong in the room at all. Literally, when they went around, did introductions and everything, I just told them exactly why. I was like, I didn't start any business. I'm not an angel investor. I'm here to learn. And they all respected it.
Wow.
So I was like 22 at the time. Yeah.
How did you get the idea? How did you hear about that event to even go in the door? Where was the inspiration?
I was just trying to figure out like, hey, what can I do next? What can I do? I got like $40,000 to my name. What can I do? And I was getting really interested in startups and startup events, and then realized that like, hey, all these startups are taking funding and investment. And then I was like, where are they getting this investment from? And then here found like two of the investment, the angel investors in Pittsburgh, like the groups, and saw that there was this luncheon that you could like buy yourself into if you had a company. And I had an Instagram company basically. So that's what I put down as it. And that's how I got into it.
Nice. Yeah, I think back, I struggled with drugs and alcohol, and I quit in 2012, and have been clean ever since. But right around that time when I got clean, I still had all the wreckage of being broke from having bad habits. And I remember there was like a real estate meeting. I think I had a property under contract, and I thought I had a joint venture partner lined up who didn't want any parts of the deal. And I remember feeling inspired to go there. I woke up really early that morning, went to the gym for the first time in, you know, I think most of my life, and have been going ever since. And I remember showing up at like 7:38 o'clock, and it was kind of a similar thing. And I met a guy, you know, that morning. If I didn't go, and I thought like I didn't want to go, I was feeling broke, and you know, that was an uncomfortable position. He ended up funding that deal for me, and then the ability to fund that deal continued to open more and more doors. So that was kind of a similar, I remember being uncomfortable at that point. And, you know, here we are a few years later. Thank God things are better than they were back then.
Exactly. That's what I try to tell everyone. Just put yourself in those uncomfortable positions. I still do to this day. Like if it's something I don't want to do, networking event, I'm not a big networker. And my partner is always pulling me into networking events. What? Let's do it, because you never know.
Nice, nice. So how can listeners get some more information about you or the company if they were thinking about running some ads?
So if you go to motivated-leads.com, motivated-leads.com, just fill out a form there, book a call. Literally, me and Brian take every single call. We have 100 plus investors that we work with. But we're there with you along the way. We have a team to help build everything on the back end and stuff, but we know the markets inside and out, and have 30-day review calls with all of our clients. So you'll personally get to talk to either me or him. So feel free to go there and book a call with one of us.
All right, cool. Sounds good. Hey, I appreciate you, you know, blocking out the time and spending this hour and just giving so freely of your knowledge. Thanks for coming on the show, Chad.
Definitely, Dan. I appreciate you as well.
Off-market real estate deals. All of us real estate investors covet that rare, profitable off-market real estate deal, often bought with very little competition. The problem is many investors futilely try to develop their source of off-market deals through real estate agents or wholesalers, only to become frustrated when they discover that they are not the only buyer in that real estate agent or wholesaler's network. The only real way to have a consistent source of off-market real estate deals is to develop a business of attracting those deals. Enter the REI Deal Machine, originally developed as a resource for high-volume investors to build teams of drivers who are literally driving their market looking for rundown and distressed property. The REI Deal Machine simplifies the process of route tracking, lead generation, and literal push-button marketing to allow you to focus on the highest value skill set a real estate investor can build, and that is negotiating profitable real estate deals. For a limited time, you can register for free access to the REI Deal Machine at reidealmachine.com. You have a chance to play around with the system, take a demo, and actually begin using the app at no cost. So go register free right now at reidealmachine.com. And thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. Are you interested in receiving my weekly Big Idea email, where I provide the most valuable jewel of wisdom that I discovered during the recording of the most recent episode? Sign up at reidiamonds.com. At that site, you can also access our 201 episode archive. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. In 2020, my house flipping business, Diamond Equity Investments, bought and sold 283 houses. So far this year, we've done 275. Most were houses, a few were apartment buildings, and we currently have another 149 deals in our inventory, either under construction or awaiting closing. So here are three ways that you and I can do business. Number one, if you are interested in having access to real estate deals that you can buy, fix, and flip for profit, go to accessrealestatedeals.com. Two, if you're an accredited investor who is seeking double-digit returns, you can sign up to receive my private mortgage investment opportunity emails at fundrehabdeals.com. That is how you join my network of private lenders to potentially fund my projects. And third, three, last but not least, I am always buying houses that I can flip and occupied apartment buildings with below-market rents. If you have a deal that fits that description in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. We are at the conclusion, my friend. Next up, we have California real estate agent, investor, and probate expert, Bill Gross, joining us to discuss the nuance of probate deals. Probate deals are, you know, one of the biggest sources of real estate investor deals. Important topic. We're going to talk about how to find them, market to them, and get them to the closing table quickly. I'll catch you and Bill next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.